I will start with Bill Brady, chairman of the AEC. The NPRA has recently made some statements about the industry not moving from dream to reality. And the terminology they use is not that they have not produced gallons, but it's they have not been able to move from dream to reality, which suggests that it's a fait accompli. We have some CEOs here who are working on projects, and I think that's not true. And I want to ask Bill, what can you tell us about your plants, your plant plans, your time frame, your commercialization strategy right out of the gate here?
Sure. One thing I think that is a bit of an elephant in the room with regard to the industry and statements like that is back in 2006 and 2007, there were a lot of promises made, a lot of hype created around plants getting built at that time, and it didn't happen. And I think it didn't happen for a lot of different reasons. Fact is, it didn't happen. So there is a credibility gap in the industry. And so I think what you're seeing now is a number of companies who have attracted meaningful partners, whether they be oil companies or agricultural companies or waste management companies, for example. And they're putting together some serious, well-funded plants. So you asked me specifically about Mascoma. Mascoma has a project in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan based on hardwood, and it is a joint venture with Valero. We also have a timber company by the name of J.M. Longyear in the joint venture as well. So we tried to pull together the right supply chain partners to make this thing not just a hype or a dream, but a reality. And I think, we use the Mascoma example, but you can look across the industry and find a number of these that have very solid partnerships, very solid projects, and they'll start to break ground and build these plants in the coming months.
Jim, you want to go ahead?
Well, at Zeachem, we've kind of done things the slow way, which is the way you do it in the chemicals and the refining industry. And I think what you're seeing now is, and going back to what you were saying, Bill, is that 2 or 3 years ago it was all hype and PowerPoints were in fashion and a lot of statements were made that didn't make sense. They made sense if you're in Silicon Valley, but if you're in the real world, they don't make sense. So I think what you're seeing now is kind of the real companies that have done things the right way, get the lab done, get the pilot work, build the demo, go to first commercial. Those people are starting to get ready to go to commercial. In terms of Zeachem, we announced earlier this year that our first phase of our demo plant was completed. It started up. We'll be adding to that. We just announced today an AFRI grant to take us on a jet gasoline and diesel. So, and we've started work on our first commercial. We received a USDA loan guarantee. So we're well on our way, but I think there's a number of companies that maybe had done it more the tried and true way that you're now seeing to emerge and are probably more realistically probable to be successful than maybe some of the early guys that had great talk, great PowerPoint, but really not much behind it.
Mm-hmm. And Amagoa has a plan in Southwest Kansas they're developing. Amagoa is in a unique position because you're diversified in the industry already. Can you tell us a little bit about rolling out that plant?
Yes, I'd be happy to. We are in a unique position. We have a significant interest in starch ethanol production today, but we have a strong belief that cellulose really holds great promise for the future of the ethanol industry. We have been involved in developing cellulose for 10 years, so this is not a new thing. I am also very heartened to see things move from promises and the era of potential and, 5 years from now to what I believe this year will be the era of development, of construction. I know that we certainly have a plant under construction already in southwestern Kansas, commercial scale, 25 million gallons a year plus 20 megawatts of co-power. And we expect to be able to complete that facility. We started construction in September of last year. We've made tremendous progress. We have, the site is graded, the preliminary engineering is all done, the roads are all laid in, virtually all of the equipment has been ordered. We have foundations in the ground, tanks are starting to go up. We will have a facility that we'll be producing in 2013. Excuse me, in the fourth quarter, and it's very exciting to be in that position finally to be able to say yes, there is reality, and we see a strong future for cellulose still.
And so let's pour down a little bit on each one of these projects from a partnership perspective, because what seems to be happening in the industry is there's more and more partnerships, there's diverse sets of strategics involved in all three of your projects. Maybe we start this way and go that way. Maybe it's the least appropriate for you because, you know, Avangoa is doing most of the legwork in building this plant. But I want to hear everybody talk about not only the importance of partnerships with regard to their current projects, but also the importance of partnerships moving forward. What types of partnerships we're talking about, and what types of partnerships would actually help create the value, you know, create the real value proposition going forward. So let's start with you, Chris.
Yeah, from Avangoa's standpoint, again, it's a little bit different. We, Avangoa was founded in the 1940s as a major engineering and major industrial construction company, and so we build our own facilities. But we design and build our own facilities, and it's Avangoa technology, and at the same time, we do value partnerships, and we have partnerships with enzyme companies. We have partnerships with other technology providers, and we certainly are working towards the development. We believe that it's very important to see the success of more than one technology, and we strongly believe that we'll see that this year.
Jim, what about you?
Well, I think the role of partners is critical, although I think that a good partner can't make a bad business good. And I think that's part of what is shaking out now in the space. But, for example, one of our key partners is Greenwood Resources. They're the nation's largest hybrid poplar producer. We signed a long-term agreement with them. Feedstock is critical. And I think the dirty little secret of cellulosic ethanol and chemicals is you've got to control your feedstock or you'll be at price risk on the feedstock. Mm-hmm. So your ability to do long-term agreements, I think, is really critical towards fixing a price, which then lets you put together the project finance and all that. So we start with the feedstock agreements, and we feel like our model's replicable around the world. We also have partnerships with people like Valero that, you know, they're investing in your guys. They've been very candid that they like to build facilities. That's what oil companies do. And, you know, coming out of the oil industry, they're neither evil nor stupid. If they don't want to put money in the space, it's because there's no money to be made. If there's money to be made, they will put money in the space. So it's a pretty simple proposition. So on some of these partnerships, you need to advance your business to a level to where that can be seen. But something that we're seeing that we're very excited about, because we make a large number of chemicals, is that you're starting to see consumer companies enter into the fray. So we recently signed an agreement with Procter & Gamble. We cannot say what it is or what it does, but it's pretty intriguing, and we're seeing more people like that. You've seen Coca-Cola come out, and it's interesting because I think earlier on the industry was trying to push the rope uphill to push cellulosics through, and now what you're seeing is you're seeing the end consumer companies pulling it through, and that gets your midstream converters online. So I'm really excited about what we're seeing from just a whole host of these end consumer products companies, because it's always better to have somebody want to buy your product than to have to sell somebody to buy it. So the P&Gs of the world and the Coca-Colas are going to drive production through, and I think you'll see a shift to those partners on a commercial side, and then you'll see the oil industry step in to actually build the facilities.
I've been at Mascoma for 2 years, and I can remember the first days when I got there. A number of people took me aside, including board members who shall remain nameless, and said, look, you got two enemies here, corn ethanol producers and oil companies. I said, okay, I got that, corn ethanol, oil companies, enemies. And here I am 2 years later, writing an S-1 to try to take the company public based on two business opportunities. One, a bioengineered yeast for the corn ethanol producers, and two, a project in Michigan with the biggest oil refiner in the country. So it just goes to show you, I think, how the thinking has changed over that period of time. But having said that, Brooke, I think any company that's going to be successful in second generation biofuels has got to be really good at pulling together complex supply chain partnerships. And I think you've got to be good at it from matching competencies. So pulling in, Chris mentioned the enzyme companies or whatever, you know, pulling in people who have competencies that you don't. And the other thing you've got to be really good at, and this is a lot harder, is finding a way to share the value among all those partners in a fair way that keeps everybody motivated. the Michigan plant we talked about, and this is public, so I can state it, Valero is going to contribute somewhere around $150 million, maybe a little bit more. So, you know, a lot of thought's got to go in. You know, that's serious money. You know, a lot of thought's got to go into how do they have the right rewards and incentives without completely burying, you know, the technology companies in the first place. So it's a very complex issue, but I think it's absolutely critical.
What is this bioengineered, given where we are, what is this bioengineered product? Because I think what we're seeing in the industry is we're seeing these co-products pop out and create efficiencies for conventional biofuel producers. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, one thing, I'll take the bait to do a little commercial, but before I do, I think one thing we need to do more of is figure out the collaboration opportunities between first and second generation ethanol producers. I think, of course, there are opportunities in diversifying feedstocks for first generation. I think there are productivity type technologies like the one I'll tell you from Mascoma. You know, Gevo, for example, has got a way to make corn ethanol plants produce higher value products. These are all things I think we got to figure out ways to make that happen faster together. But the Mascoma bioengineered yeast, this is an FDA-approved product, which is a drop-in yeast for existing yeasts used in corn ethanol plants. And in replacing with the old yeast with our yeast, you can eliminate the need for enzymes and boost the yields. So no capital required, but straight drop-in yeast, and it really helps out the economics and the costs of a given plant.
Before we move on, anybody else want to take the bait and talk about COVID? I want to be fair. If not, we will move on. All right. Jim, we'll start with you. So here's the question that we always get. So this is a somewhat self-serving question for a government affairs person. What happened in the last 4 years? So when I look at the RFS, cellulosic biofuels became an explicit part of energy policy in the United States just about 4 years ago, which is not a very long time. So we have a situation here where our cornerstone policy, the RFS, is being scrutinized. It's very aggressive, but it also sets the bar very high. So over the last couple of years, we've had a situation where people in 2007 said they'd build in 2009. Why didn't they build in 2009? Was it a financial markets thing? Was it a we needed a little more time on the technology thing? Was it because we needed to adjust to a marketplace that all of a sudden was going like this and commodities were going crazy? Or was it a combination? So could you shed a little light on what happened?
Well, I'd argue there's probably three things. First of all, you had government officials probably trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. So they used an econometric model where every year there's a little more. But I've never seen a business grow that way. I see businesses kind of stall around, and then all of a sudden somebody figures out how to make money. I mean, as an old guy, let's look at fracking, because everybody's complaining about fracking. I love fracking. better living through fracking. But if you said 10 years ago to me that people are going to be fracking in the Marcel Basin and producing crude oil competitively at world markets, I would have thought that maybe you needed some hospitalization, because it couldn't happen. And it couldn't happen, and then it did happen, and then you saw what happened. So what? Same with the corn ethanol industry. It kind of didn't go anywhere, and then somebody figured out how to make about a buck a gallon. Amazingly enough, when somebody figured out how to make a buck a gallon, capital flowed and stuff happened. So if you predicted the corn ethanol industry, the government guys would have, the economists would have done that. It was truly the hockey stick. So part of this is just it's very hard to predict what's going to happen, and generally it doesn't predict the way the econometric models want to. The other thing is, and we've discussed it, and this is something our industry's got to get better at, we had a lot of guys doing a lot of hype. It was Silicon Valley. And in Silicon Valley, when you build software, and I ran a software business for a while, so I can actually say this, it's amazing what you can do that you haven't done. And so the mere fact you haven't done something, you can tell people you've done it. By the time they figure out where it is, you build it. Concrete and steel is fundamentally different, so it's much, much harder. So I think you had a lot of people that didn't understand the complexity of building assets, and this is something you and the audience certainly understand. You don't build an ethanol plant overnight. It takes time, and you've got to have a design. And once you have the design, now you can copy it real quickly. So we also had a little bit of that. And then first of all, you had just maybe bad models of how it's going to build out, and then you had the challenges of people who didn't know what they were doing, talking about what they were going to do. But then the third phase that is really hurting the industry right now, and I think we've got to get a grip on, is that it's all about policy, and it's about consistency. Because the thing we haven't discussed about yet about why the industry's gone slower is around project finance. And if I was looking at the industry now, I would say, who's got good project finance skills and who's got decent technology, those people will win. Great technology without the ability to finance doesn't get you anything. To do project finance, classical project finance, you need fixed feedstock, you need a fixed EPC contract, this is what you need offtake, and then you need a process wrap. All that takes financial security. So when we're operating in an industry, we're trying to put a deal together right now, and we don't know whether the accelerated depreciation is going to be there. We don't know whether the credits are going to be there. That kind of makes it hard to go down to your local banker and convince them to do anything, because they're going to say, well, let me see, that's a 2-year agreement, that's a 3-year agreement. Yeah, we'll give you 2 years of that. Well, by the way, 2 years is my construction time. So that really doesn't help me. So I think all three of those things need to change. I think a lot of the people that we're over-promoting are gone, and I think the industry is becoming more responsible, although I would argue we still need to raise the bar. I think the technology is there, and now that the ability to project finance is largely limited by the people actually trying to help us, because the government tends not to do programs that are very long. They tend to do very short and renew it, and from a project finance standpoint, that does us no good. And I know that's kind of sounding like I'm bagging, but it's the truth. Unless you have a 10 to 20 year horizon, it doesn't help project finance. Mm-hmm.
Chris, you don't agree with everything. I don't want you guys to agree. But do you agree with, I mean, you guys, you live the corn ethanol.
Absolutely. And, I mean, to a large degree, I agree with what's been said, by Jim and Bill. We had a situation, we had an economic downturn right after the RFS was passed. Certainly made financing very difficult. We were very fortunate to be involved in one of the last major financings of two starch ethanol facilities, which we built between 2008 and completed and got them online in 2010, from 2007 to 2009, really. So that was a part of our focus, but in reality, financing dried up, and particularly, and that's even for starch ethanol, for brand new technology that's been unproven without federal assistance such as loan guarantee programs and that sort of thing, there's just no financing available, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult for any company to take, even if the company has the money, to take the sole risk of a major investment that's several hundred million dollars. So that's a difficult thing. Certainly, it was nice to see both DOE and USDA kind of finally develop some loan guarantees and to initiate those, even though it was virtually 5 years after the program was initiated when the loan guarantees finally came through. That's been a key impetus in allowing a few of these facilities to start, I believe. And so that's one of the major things that has changed. And yet still we struggle on the policy side of having a incentive which doesn't cost anything until there's actual production. It doesn't do any good really until there's actual production, but it's scheduled to expire at the end of this year. And so we struggle with that from year to year. As Jim said, if you don't have some policy that looks forward 5 or 10 years, you get very little benefit from that policy, in reality on a financing side. But we have that, we're certainly making progress, and I'm still heartened.
Okay. Bill, what about you? I'm going to tee it up with an absolute statement, so that makes me absolutely wrong. It's not the technology, it's the market. Is that true?
No. No. I mean, it's the technology and the market. Mm-hmm. I think Jim sort of said it well. If you had have a good technology, you can't get financing, that doesn't really matter, and vice versa. I think that technology's got to come first. We're in a commodity, very competitive commodity industry, and any successful company has got to have a really solid cost position. It's got to make sure the process works. The good news today relative to 5 years ago is we have a number of pilot plants across the industry that have thousands and thousands of hours of operation. We've got companies that are trying to go public, so they've had to be very truthful about their costs. And so it's a completely different ballgame. But I think it's a matter of the technology and of the market. One other thing I'll say on the market side, particularly with regard to RFS and some of the government policies that drive the market, the most important thing is clear market signals. In some way, it almost doesn't matter what the signal is, provided it's clear and consistent. And I think that's one thing, Jim alluded to it in trying to raise money for some of these plants. If that's a yearly extender game, man, it is going to be hard for everyone to nail down a bunch of plants going forward.
And just focusing on technology for a second, one of the things we get on the Hill is the technology, you know, can you show us progress? Can you just, we'll go in reverse order, just, you know, starting with Bill and then back this way. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, if someone comes up to you and said, well, you know, you're flatlining, the industry's flatlining on its technological process. Cost of production is where it is, and you're going to live with what you got. What do you say? Can you tell the audience about technological improvement in the last 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, look, I can talk specifically about our company. I can't speak for every other company in particular, but, you know, I know when I first came to our company, it was not very focused on costs, very enamored with the technology, not very focused on costs. I remember one of my first meetings, having a very complicated technical presentation. I had a headache. You know, I was sweating. I couldn't understand what the heck was going on. And at the end, I just said, well, what's the cost per gallon? You know, I was thinking gasoline's $3, $4, whatever a gallon. What's the cost per gallon? And the ex-director of our process R&D at the time looked at me and said, why do you need to know that? And so I think, again, just to prove the point, I think there was a time when there was not a lot of focus on costs and what's going to drive things commercially. I think in the past number of years, you see a tremendous amount of progression in costs. We're, you know, this is public in what we filed, but our cost per gallon on our first 20 million gallon plant is $1.77 per gallon. You know, I can tell you when I asked that question a couple of years ago, it was probably about double that on the same basis. So that's just one company's story. I'm sure there are others who have that same type of progression.
Yeah. Chris, you want to respond to that? Not to Bill, to the technological improvement.
Yeah, certainly there have been technological improvements. Again, you know, we've been working on our technology truly for 10 years. We built a pilot plant back in, you know, 2003, I think we started working on that. First produced cellulosic ethanol there in 2007. We then built a demonstration scale plant with it was like 1.3 million gallons per year in capacity. Ran that for thousands of hours, as somebody just said a minute ago. And that of course makes a huge difference. We by able to scale up from laboratory to pilot to demonstration scale facility and to prove this technology, again, for thousands of hours, makes us feel much more confident about moving into a commercial scale endeavor. At the same time, there are the other things that you have to have, and again, feedstock requirements were mentioned a moment ago, and the feedstock requirements for a cellulosic facility are significant. They are a major issue that has to be addressed. We've been on the ground for over 3 years in Hugoton, Kansas, becoming a part of the local community, visiting with farmers, contracting with farmers. We have now contracted the majority of our feedstock needs for multiple years into the future, and that is one of the biggest hurdles. I mean, it's very difficult to justify the investment and the cost of a big plant until you have feedstock that you know for sure is going to be there. And it's very difficult to have feedstock that you know for sure is going to be there until you build a plant. It's a chicken and egg question for sure. Mm-hmm. So, but have those changes happened? Yes, we've developed a great deal in the feedstock side. We're very comfortable with our technology, and that's the primary change over the last few years.
Jim.
Well, you know, the only thing I'd add to that is that it's probably hard if you're looking from the outside, because if you go back 4 or 5 years ago, the space was being funded by VCs, and you already bagged on your VCs, but I will now, is that they're wonderful people, but they really like the extreme. So the more crazy, you know, they're all about transformational change. And so I think a lot of ideas were funded that were just crazy, crazy science. Sometimes that works, but unfortunately it tarnished the industry a little bit. And it's interesting to me that when you see the people that are standing, still at this point, they tend to not have as much of the revolutionary technology. The story's not quite as good, again, on a PowerPoint, but it's much better in terms of risk management to actually deploy into concrete and steel. So if you're looking on the outside, you heard claims way back of 50 cent a gallon ethanol. Well, now you're hearing a higher number, but the higher number is actually a realer number, and the other numbers were just fake. And so staying on the outside, they're saying, well, gee, it doesn't look like the industry's improving. I would argue the industry's improving tremendously because it's getting down to where multiple people have announced that they can make money without subsidies. Now, they make more with it, obviously. But that it's, the numbers today you're hearing are much more solid, and people have been forced through the S1 process to do a cleansing of the truth, which I think is good. And so you're seeing an industry that's really just kind of maturing. So depending on which side of the glass you're looking through, you either say, wow, this industry is really coming forward. It's just about ready to break the cusp. Because another thing I think people should look at is how much money is being spent on concrete and steel. Because people focus on, gee, there's no production yet. Well, you got to build. It takes a while to build. So if I look at it and I see, people are building. I saw a picture this morning that showed tanks going up. As an old industry guy, that makes me comfortable. That's not hype. If somebody paid money to invest to build the tanks for the plant, there's probably something behind that. So I think that's something people ought to be looking at. The amount of money that's going into concrete and steel this year is very high. The amount next year is going to be another dimension higher. Those are the predictors. The gallons will follow, but the construction has to start it.
Makes sense. Are there any questions? The question idea was great until I turned up the lights and I can't possibly see the microphone. Is there a question over here?
In the middle.
Oh, it's Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Rachel Gantz with Oil Price Information Service. Just wanted to find out, obviously you guys mentioned that the cellulosic ethanol tax credit expires at the end of this year. What are the chances that it'll be extended either for 1 year or a multi-year?
That was my question four. So do you want to talk? Well, let's talk a little bit about, let's turn that, to set that question up, let's turn it a little. Why do those two things matter? From a business perspective, you've got two interesting incentives. Why do they matter from, start with Bill, go back to the sort of thing. Why do they matter to Mascoma?
Yeah, the two being the PTC and the accelerated depreciation.
Yes.
I think the first important reason to extend is what I said before, the market signals have to remain clear. The second important thing is, look, these are new technologies, and companies like Valero or any other big strategic who comes in, they're taking risks. And everything that can be done to de-risk the project gives it a much better chance in their boardroom of getting significant amounts of capital. And those two things, particularly the accelerated depreciation, is a de-risker. And so that's a very big deal, I think, for all of us in attracting capital to the segment.
Jim, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, and maybe just for the audience, accelerated depreciation lets a company take about 50% of the depreciation up in the first year, which then you can actually, what they call, monetize. So it actually brings in capital in the business up front. And it's a great program because the only reason you get it is that you actually built something. You're going to get the depreciation anyway. All the government is letting you do is take it a little bit quicker. So looking in my crystal ball, which I checked this morning,
yep, good.
I feel good about that one because that really makes economic sense. It's done in all kinds of industries. That one should go. I think the other one will go too. Crystal ball is a little more cloudy on the production credit, but it makes sense. It is a new industry. The problem is, and this is what drives me crazy as an entrepreneur in this space who's trying to finance a first commercial plant, if you're going to do it. Don't wait till December 31st to do something that we kind of all know you're going to do. And you guys in the corn ethanol industry, you have seen that as they continually evergreen during your regimes on the producer tax credit. It just makes it really hard to put together project financing because you think you may have this, you think you may have that, but you really kind of don't. And until you do, you can't put it in. So we're operating under the assumption that those will both go forward, but who knows?
Chris, you have thoughts on that? You're highly engaged on government affairs. I think you have a crystal ball too, right?
Yeah, no, I do not have a crystal ball. But, when you look at the production tax credit and the accelerated depreciation, again, the important thing about those two incentives is they don't cost anything to the American public until there's actual production. And secondly, they cost a relatively small amount of money compared to, just to bring us close to parity, just to bring us close to even with what the rest of the energy world already gets. Energy has always been an encouraged pursuit, encouraged by the United States government in many ways. And frankly, the energy incentives that are given to oil production, for example, are substantially exceed anything that is currently given to cellulose or biofuels. Energy incentives given to other types of energy, being solar or wind, exceed those given to biofuels. What we are trying to do really is just kind of level the playing field and move biofuels up so that we can compete on an even basis with the other forms of energy.
Any other questions before we move on to some other, touch on a couple other policy issues? Okay, while Rachel has us on policy, let's touch another third rail. It's the $6 million question. So recently, and I know a number of people in the audience have talked to us about this, the NPRA has petitioned to retroactively waive their obligations in 2011 under the Renewable Fuel Standard. As everybody knows, the cellulosic biofuel targets were reduced, and they don't want to pay for waiver credits for a fuel that did not emerge in that year. Starting with you, Chris, because I know you love third rails when they involve the government, is NPRA right? What's the answer to this question?
NPRA is a master at misdirection, I think. And no, they are not right.
I'm a former member.
That's why we're getting this.
Oh, good.
We're going to spice this up.
That's why I get
yeah.
to go first.
Yeah.
The RFS is doing exactly what it was intended to do. The EPA looks out in advance, 2 years, and then more specifically 1 year in advance, and they say, this is what we think a realistic production estimate for cellulose is, and this is the number that we're going to set. That advanced notice gives everyone the ability to plan for that number. Compliance with that number, first of all, EPA does its best to do a realistic good faith estimate, but many times things intervene, market economics, economic recessions, that sort of thing. Sometimes they overestimate, sometimes they underestimate, but it's going to be close. And in reality, it's very close. We may be a little bit short this year, we may be a little bit long next year. The fact that EPA does this projection in advance and gives everyone the chance to plan for it, and in addition, the RFS being well designed also provides multiple means for the obligated parties to comply with those obligations. There have been RINs that have been carried over from prior years that can be used to satisfy portions of that obligation. You can buy the cellulosic waiver credits or, in essence, delay, at least initially, some of your obligations. So there are multiple ways that obligated parties can comply with this. It's not like they're paying a fine or a penalty. And one last point, we're talking $6 million. And that's a lot of money to me. It really is a lot of money. But when you look at it in the context of national energy policy, that is less than, it's roughly 1/1,000th of a cent per gallon. Is this having an impact on consumers? No. For every gallon that's sold as transportation fuel in the country. And on top of that, you compare that $6 million, which is a one-time annual cost, to the fact that we are currently spending well over $1 billion every day to purchase oil that's being imported from foreign countries. In the scheme of things, this is a very close estimate.
Jim, you're up.
As a former member of the evil oil empire, I need to speak out on my brethren. Actually, I kind of get a kick out of this whole thing because it is $6 million, and it's only a $1 trillion market in the oil space that we're talking about. So I can understand why they're so concerned about the $6 million and probably spending $7 million to petition getting rid of the $6 million.
Right.
But there is a fear that they do have is that if you are in the oil business, you are a little nervous about the government because you are not well-liked. Behind Big Tobacco, you're the second enemy of the country. So there is a fear that it's not the 6 million today, it's where it could go and does it ever go away. So and they've come up with a great tagline, you know, how can you pay for something that doesn't exist? I'd argue I do it every day when I pay my taxes, so I can get over that one real quick. The second thing is that it's a little disingenuous because this is the EPA. And as a former oil guy, I would tell you, of all the things the EPA has done to the oil industry, many of them good, this is the least expensive of anything I've ever seen the EPA come out with. So it's almost trivial. So they're trying to wage a bigger battle. But I think if we all just use calm heads and realize it is 6 million, don't change everything, because once you open the doors, you know, I would caution, it could get worse if the doors get open. So maybe you ought to just take that and move along. But I think it is important that we just stay the course, don't really worry about it. And I think it's kind of comical, really, to sit back and look at. Because, hey, they got a great argument, a great tagline. I love the marketing line there. But at the end of the day, it's $6 million. And they will spend at least $6 million arguing against the $6 million. So from an economic perspective, it doesn't make any sense.
So we're seeing some agreement on retroactive waivers being a bad thing. Bill, are you there?
I don't have a lot more to add to that, other than to say, to the extent we keep going year after year and not producing any
that's the key
cellulosic gallons, we give them the ammunition to have outstanding press releases and sound bites. So I sort of turn it back on to us and say, doggone it, let's get these projects lined up, let's get metal in the ground, start talking about the money that's being spent, as Jim said earlier, and we combat it with facts and we combat it with building plants.
You know, you got a great point. We're like an industry with the firing squad in front of us is the oil guys, and we're handing them bullets. And that's never a good idea. So I don't think it's so much that we're not meeting the target. I think you hit the head on it. There's a difference between zero and one.
Yeah.
And once you're at one, you can at least do the math of what percentage you have. So as soon as we get some production out there, I think this argument will go away quickly.
Fair enough. Thanks, Rachel, for throwing us down that path. Any other questions? All right, I'm going to keep asking them then. So now that we've established credibility, which I hope we have, we are going to look at the horizon. So we have some steel and concrete going in the ground. But people, of course, now that we say we're building, they say, okay, so how much? How much can you do? What does the hockey stick look like?
Yeah.
So, Bill, starting with you, what can you share, you know, you're going public, what can you share about your model of expansion, what you see out in the future with regard to your company? And if you want, maybe tell a story about where you think the industry can go. If you don't, then I'm going to come back and ask you again when everybody's done with their company. So
okay.
Your choice.
Well, let me talk about our company and how we view that, because I think proliferation of plants and how that's going to get done is really important, because I don't think any of us sitting here or any of our colleagues in this industry are in this to build a plant and go home. So the way we think about it is as follows. We think about it in development hubs. So I mentioned we have a partnership with Valero on our Kinross, Michigan plant. We also have a 10-year development agreement with Valero in North America, where we will replicate it once we get the first one up and working. In addition to that, we have a hub with JM Longyear, which is a timber company in the upper Midwest, to develop the upper Midwest and southern Ontario. So that's another hub of development where we not only build the first one, but we proliferate. And then we've got government support in the province of Alberta. And we're working on a particular project there in Drayton Valley, Alberta. But we have designs to replicate that a number of times in the province. So we look at it as having solid developmental hubs from which, you know, you can build a number of plants. It was interesting. I was with the team from ICM last night, and I was just sort of going back and checking my math and saying, we have this plan to build all these plants over the next decade. Is it too aggressive? Is it, you know, is it realistic? And they reminded me that the first generation ethanol build out was about a new plant being started every week, which made me feel a lot better about my plan, because I was well within that range. But, yeah. So that's how we think about it. And I think in the broader context, when you look at what first generation ethanol did, you know, ramping up quickly, it's not out of the question once we prove these technologies.
It's So, Jim, what about your company?
Well, you know, we're starting work on our first commercial on the project financing, putting that together. That'll be co-located with our Boardman plan, again, to de-risk. And I think that the challenge going forward is, and I'm not trying to minimize the technology. You got to get that to work or people aren't going to finance you in the first place. But then how do you set up for the second, third, fourth plan? And so what we're trying to do is use classical, traditional project finance methods. I mean, our business thesis has always been no new bugs, no new equipment, no new risk. That includes project finance. So if you look at how you build out industries, and people say, oh, it can't go that fast, well, look at the power industry. I mean, Calpine went from some small number to 20,000 megawatts in 10 years. Well, the way they did that is they had a plan, and they had a vision, and they had a rolling bond fund for their project financing. We're looking at doing the same types of techniques. So goal number one is you've got to go out and you've got to establish the biomass centers that can support it, get your contracts in place. That's where we see the biggest focus is, because a plant's no good if you got nothing to feed it. A plant's also no good if you got nowhere to take your product. So you got to think about both things. So not every place is good. So you pick your sites, you get those developed, then you start doing the project finance on multiple sites at a time. But I would argue you probably ought to use classical project finance techniques that have been used in things like the power industry, where they've done a lot of replication. And that's what all of us want to eventually do, is each plant is going to be unique. I don't think, you know, when you use, I'm an old ops guy, corn is wonderful because all corn is pretty much created equal from a processing point of view. Although even in an ethanol plant, all corn's not created equal. But compared to biomass, corn is much more uniform. So it lends itself towards more of a cookie cutter process. Biomass is a little more challenging as you go around. You know, wood is not the same. You're not going to be using the same wood everywhere. You'll use different residuals. So there's going to be a little more customization, but the same concept is in place, that you develop your plant, that becomes your template for your project finance, and then you just keep rolling that along. And it can go pretty quickly. I mean, you look what the power industry did. You look at what wind did. Stuff can be built quick as long as people think, A, it works, and that there's whatever structure you need for the project finance guys to provide the security and the risk profile that they want to finance it.
Chris, can you share anything about your growth plan?
Sure. From Abengoa's perspective, we have not invested hundreds of millions of dollars just to build one plant. You know, that's just doesn't make a lot of sense. So our belief at this point is that, you know, we will build more, hopefully several. We are, in fact, actively involved in site searches now for next locations. We obviously want to build and prove the technology at a commercial scale, but at the same time, in order to be prepared to build the next facility, we have, you know, site searches and permitting that we expect to do well in advance. So we're working on that now. This facility we're building today is a greenfield site. It is not co-located with anything else. We believe that, you know, we're investigating as our next site both greenfield facilities and co-locating facilities at our existing plants. We have, fortunately, six to choose from. At those six facilities, we have a built-in infrastructure advantage. We have, you know, roads. We have tanks. We have fermentation capacity and distillation capacity and loadout and scales and all that sort of stuff that we can utilize in order to make this more efficient, make a cellulose add-on more efficient. We think there's a high likelihood that we will look at some of our at co-locating future cellulose facilities at our existing facilities, and we're in the process of moving in that direction now.
So switching, and this will be sort of our last topic. But how do we get from here to there? What really matters? And Jim, I'm going to ask you this question because you just were awarded a loan guarantee. Every time I hear someone refer to a loan guarantee as a grant, it suggests to me that they don't really understand not only the basics of loan guarantees, but also why we need them and what we're actually jumping through. I mean, you know, you call it the valley of death. That's a little dramatic. But we actually have to hurdle over something to get into the first commercialization in order to demonstrate you can make money, and that's when the money flows in. Can you just clarify, you know, why a loan guarantee? What is a loan guarantee? And then what else? What else do we need?
Well, first of all, let me describe what a loan guarantee is that, you know, we just want a $232.5 million loan guarantee for our first commercial, but that is for 60% of the debt, which means we still need to go on the open market to do 40%. And I think what the USDA is trying to do, and I think it's a great policy, but it's not free money, it's not a grant, we don't have it yet. As I joke, when you hear about these grant awards, what it really means is the company has a right to negotiate to see if they can close the deal. So it's kind of like your banker telling you, yeah, I'll talk to you, come on in. So we still need to do all that. They're very strict. They're running it like a bank would. But what it does is it gives you a leg up, and I think it does two things. One is it gives you some credibility, which then to have further discussions, you know, it's obviously the USDA has done some due diligence. I think it helps you get moving. But at the end of the day, I'm still going to have to convince banks to put in the money. And so it's a helping hand, but it's not a handout. A grant, you know, the way I think of a grant is, here's $232 million. Mm-hmm. That's a grant. That would be cool. Mm-hmm. That's not what the USDA is doing. They're being very careful about doing it and trying to do it with normal market mechanisms. And the great thing about the USDA, and I'll brag on them versus the DOE, is that the USDA has actually done this before. They understand project finance. They've been helping farmers and rural things for a long time. So I think there's a huge difference also between the DOE grants, which you've heard about, which tend to be problematic and very difficult because you're asking people to administer it that maybe don't have the same experience. With the USDA, extremely professional. It's like working with a bank.
Chris, you want to take a shot at that, and then we'll finish with Bill. You know, what has to happen to get us on the right aggressive trajectory?
Well, yeah, just to clarify one more thing, and Jim said it several times, but people still don't get it. You know, a loan guarantee is not a grant. It's a loan that has to be paid back. We have a DOE. Yeah.
Darn it.
We have a loan guarantee through the Department of Energy, and of course, it's a wonderful method to help finance a project, but it is money that we will pay back. It's money that's guaranteed by all of Abengoa. So, you know, it's a great concept. I think what we have to do in order to continue is to get some plants built, to prove technologies. Hopefully, I believe that rising tide floats all boats, that we need to prove six or seven or multiple different technologies. And once we actually have some commercial scale producing facilities, I think this has the potential to do the same thing that the starch industry did in the mid-2000s and grow at a very fast pace.
Bill? Yeah, Brooke, I think it's all about getting the financing and then proving these technologies. And I think the first one is very difficult, as we've all talked about. The second one is very important because once these technologies are proved, the capital will start flowing. The people on the hook for cellulosic gallons over time will flow to the industry. And we'll start to bring in also the intellectual capital. More and more good people will come into the industry. So I think financing and proving these technologies unlocks the whole industry.
Thank you. Well, our time is up. I don't think I've ignored any questions. I want to thank the panelists for coming up here and opening their kimonos and talking a little bit about this industry. So please give them a hand. Thank you.